Hey there, everybody. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm here with a Better Late Than Never presentation that was supposed to be on the live stream last week, but due to technical gremlins that got in the way, Dr. Alan Hopkins was unable to connect with us and share. And I invited Dr. Hopkins here to talk to you about some of the lab work that is really critical to detect whether you have imbalances in your insulin glucose regulation system. And throughout the webinar, on the long webinar that we did, we talked a lot about why it's important to keep those things under control and the dangers of excess insulin and the dangers of excess blood sugar and how you can have a blood sugar imbalance problem and you don't even know it unless you're doing the right kind of testing. And we even showed you how to do your own self-glucose testing. So I invited Dr. Alan here because he is really brilliant at lab work. That's actually one of his specialties. He's got a lot of specialties, actually. He's an ER doc by day. He's an anti-aging doc, and he's really passionate about teaching lab work to practitioners, to health coaches, to people who can actually look at labs and see functional things going on, not just, hey, you're diseased or you're not, which is kind of the conventional way that medicine looks. So I briefly touched on some of the tests that are really critical for helping you to know if you have a blood sugar imbalance early on before you get diagnosed with diabetes. So thank you so much for being here. I so appreciate you being here and taking time out of your busy day.
All right, Dr. Rita Marie, thanks so much for having me. And I am super excited to talk about, you know, how insulin actually affects multiple other things in our body. And there is a reason for the season why if you have insulin resistance and sugar problems, your risk for cancer goes up, your risk for, heart attack and stroke go up. And I'm going to explain to you kind of how insulin sends off this cascade that we can measure in your bloodstream to determine what your risk is. My contact information is here. If anybody wants to reach out to me, this is my contact information. I'm always interested in what sort of questions that you might have. So before we get into the actual biomarkers themselves, I just have a couple slides that really demonstrate what this powerful hormone called insulin does. You know, many of us know that insulin is made by our pancreas. And of course, if we don't have a pancreas, you know, we can't live without insulin. And, back in 1902, there were two doctors who were really getting tired of seeing people die from diabetes. You know, back then there was no treatment for it. People would just get sick and die. And if you had type 1 diabetes, you were usually a child, and you would get sick fairly quickly and die within several weeks. If you were an adult, you know, you would live on for years, but then ultimately die from the complications due to the high blood sugars. So back then, these two doctors postulated that maybe there was a hormone that was produced inside the human gut that actually would keep the pancreas alive. And so they began cutting up dead people and taking pieces of their gut and feeding them to these kids that were dying and to these adults that were also dying from their type 2 diabetes, hoping to make a difference because, again, back then there wasn't much. And of course, guess what happened? They died anyway. And so they were made a mockery by the medical society back then. And interestingly enough, it wasn't until decades later, in the early 1970s, that we actually discovered a hormone that is produced in the human gut called glucagon-like peptide. And that peptide actually goes and it works to keep the pancreas alive and to help it produce insulin. And it's actually that glucagon-like peptide is actually one of the newer medications that people are using now in diabetes. And we like it in the treatment if you have to have pharmaceuticals. We like it because it's the synthetic version of a natural hormone that your body produces to try to help you. So those two guys, they were onto something, right? So I want to talk about insulin, though, because the importance of our pancreas is critical. And whether we have type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune condition, that about 7% of people who are thought to have type 2 actually end up having type 1, and they progress fairly rapidly despite all sorts of interventions. But we're going to focus on type 2 because type 2 is the most common. There's 79 million people with prediabetes here in the United States. And I'm sorry, that number has just been revised upward to 86 million. So it's grown significantly just since the CDC last put out the latest numbers. This means that a lot of people are having trouble with diabetes, and we're just we're just on a road to really super bad problems, right? Because diabetes is the number one cause of blindness and the number one cause of kidney failure are two largest expenses to take care of in the medical community. So let's talk about how diabetes first starts and how we might become aware that we're at risk for diabetes even before our blood sugars start to rise. If we measure this hormone called insulin, if we measure it in the fasting state, the first thing we see on the road to diabetes is higher levels of insulin. And so insulin is super important. So if we look at this pathway here, you can notice that this this little red triangle here is insulin, and it's out there in the bloodstream. Now, it has to bind to an insulin receptor on the cell membrane. Once it does so, it signals this complex series of interactions with inside each one of our cells, and ultimately results in something called a glucose transporter being transported to the surface. And just like the name is, the GLUT4 transporter actually transports glucose from the bloodstream inside the cell, where we either store it as glycogen in our liver and our muscle, or we store it as fatty acids, primarily in our belly fat we do this. And the real problem is that we're all eating way too much sugar, right? And so when we eat tons of sugar, we flood all of our cells with all of this sugar, and the glucose comes in, and the cells fill up with all the glycogen and all the fatty acids, and each one of the cells gets sick. And so they begin a process of downregulation of these insulin receptors. And so this is a diagram, maybe a little bit blurry, but to the right is like a normal cell, right? So you have these things that are called insulin receptors on the cell membrane. And if you can imagine, they're like little arms. And so the blue balls are the actual insulin. And when that insulin binds to that little arm there, then the circulating red cells in the bloodstream, called glucose, then can go through that GLUT4 transporter. So this is a normal cell, and this is how we are supposed to handle glucose normally. Well, what happens is when our cell gets sick, we start to downregulate these insulin receptors. In other words, we just start to turn them off. We don't have that many that are actually working. And so you can see here on the cell that's insulin resistant, we only are showing two insulin receptors. And so what does that happen? Well, it increases the amount of glucose in our bloodstream, and it increases the amount of insulin in our bloodstream. And so again, fasting insulin is not measured very much by normal allopathic doctors. They just don't even think to do it. But in my mind, having a lower insulin is really good, because in all my patients that I've seen, thousands and thousands of patients we've done advanced testing on, high levels of insulin are really the first thing that we see as they go down the path to diabetes. So when we look at biomarkers, and of course, everybody that I like to see and do advanced testing on, I always put them on my anti-aging circle. If you guys have seen this before, I hope I don't bore you. But I can literally put people on the circle and change their life by manipulating some of these biomarkers that I see. Because again, it's kind of like a game that we play. If one of the biomarkers is abnormal, it can signal multiple other problems along the pathway, kind of like a domino. If you hit the domino, all the other dominoes start to fall. And so my mind, we're going to focus on this green circle down here, which is a pillar of health called insulin dynamics. And, you know, we can measure in this category, we can measure insulin and C-peptide. You know, what is C-peptide? Well, there's something called proinsulin. So your pancreas has beta cells, and the beta cells produce this hormone called proinsulin. Proinsulin then is cleaved or broken down into equivalent amounts of C-peptide, which is inert. In other words, it doesn't do anything in the body. And it's also cleaved into equal amounts of insulin. And so it just turns out that we like to monitor C-peptide in the bloodstream sometimes because C-peptide is a little bit more stable. And so sometimes we feel like it's a more reliable measurement because it tends to last longer, and our instrumentation is just better at picking it up. So we can measure the hormones that are secreted by the pancreas. And by the way, you can also measure proinsulin. It's a more expensive test. There are people that have trouble converting proinsulin into insulin. So we'll really see high proinsulin levels first, and then ultimately we'll see higher levels of blood sugar. But by far and away, the most common thing that I've seen is higher levels of insulin, and those are the people that are at risk. Finally, we measure, you know, the glucose, which I think most people know about. Your audience is well-tuned to A1Cs, the three-month measurement of blood sugars. Now, here's the problem. If your insulin level is high, it literally affects the way that you make cholesterol. And so if you go up to my another pillar of health called vascular integrity, or the way we make cholesterol, our high insulin really changes the cholesterol molecules into smaller, denser, more dangerous bad cholesterol molecules. And if we do something called advanced cholesterol panel, we can actually measure this and actually see if it's happening to someone. And what we'll see on the blood test is we'll see lots of small LDL particles, and then we'll also see something called a pattern B. And that pattern B is the dangerous pattern. And so if a person has pattern B, they're much more likely to build up plaque in their arteries. And so this is really why insulin resistance and prediabetes and diabetes, this is one of the reasons why it increases the risk for stroke and heart attack, because it literally changes our cholesterol into the very dangerous type of cholesterol that we don't like. And of course, if we're eating lots of carbs, you know, one of the things we'll oftentimes see is high levels of triglycerides. And then we also see this HDL suppression and insulin dynamics. And that usually is due to the high levels of insulin making it really hard to lose weight. In fact, insulin is a fat fertilizer. And so one of the first things that we notice whenever we start somebody on exogenous insulin, we start giving them insulin shots, is within the first month they'll gain 20 or 30 pounds because they get these really high levels of insulin in their bloodstream, and that causes them to go into a fat storage mode and causes them to gain weight, and therefore their HDL tends to go down. So these are the things that I like to look at when it comes to the vascular integrity, and it's just simply all wrapped together in an advanced cholesterol panel. You won't see these changes necessarily happening with just a basic lipid panel. You'll see the triglycerides and the HDL, but you actually won't see the subclasses. So you'll miss out on the small dense LDL and the pattern B, which is, I think, is essential for people to know about. I love to look at biomarkers and teach people about them, because when they get them checked on themselves, if they do have a problem, my goodness, it can be quite motivating to show them, hey, you know, the way you eat is increasing your insulin. This is in turn increasing the amount of bad cholesterol that you have, the very dangerous kind, and it's putting you at higher risk for developing a heart attack early. Wouldn't it be great if you could get your diet under control and watch how, when you do control your diet, your insulin levels go down, and you'll actually change yourself from a pattern B into a pattern A, the light, fluffy kind of LDL cholesterol. And those small, dense LDL numbers will go down. So if you test over time, you'll see somebody who made a nutritional change dramatically improve the way their cholesterol markers look. The other thing is inflammation, of course. We do know that insulin resistance syndrome and metabolic disturbance of prediabetes and diabetes increases your inflammation markers. So if you measure a high sensitivity CRP or hsCRP, this is another one of my pillars of health. If you're walking around with a CRP that's elevated above 2, we know that that's a completely independent risk factor for stroke and heart attack. All right, so things are starting to add up now, right? So we have somebody who's got a sugar problem. Now they're at much higher risk for having a stroke and heart attack. Why? Well, they have the sugar problem that's changing the way they make cholesterol, and now it's causing this chronic inflammation. So now they've got 3 risk factors for the development of heart disease. And then insulin also does another crazy thing too. Insulin affects our thyroid hormone. And our conversion from the inactive thyroid hormone called free T4 into the active hormone called free T3 can be dramatically affected. And so if we don't measure those, we'll never know. And so when I check your thyroid for purposes of insulin resistance and sugar problems, I always get a T3 and a T4 because I want to make sure that T4 is being converted properly into T3 because oftentimes it's not. And then I always also like to look at cortisol, and the reason why is because there's a huge relationship between cortisol and insulin. When a person's cortisol goes high, their glucose goes high, and then their insulin has to respond. And the most common thing I see, of course, is people having trouble losing weight. And we almost always nail it down to inappropriately low cortisol in the morning and a super high cortisol at night when they're sleeping because they have obstructive sleep apnea. So it's one of the things we don't like to miss. So we get a morning cortisol, and it should be nice and high. And if it's not, we have to really look at a person's sleep and evaluate whether or not they have the potential for sleep apnea. Because if we fix that, we can actually fix the insulin resistance, which can then in turn fix the cholesterol problem, which then in turn can reduce inflammation. And by the way, people start losing weight after that, and they feel great. And then finally, my fifth pillar of health is nutrition. And of course, vitamin D is super important. I know you talk about it. Research has indicated to us that if we can get the levels high enough, like above 60, we start to see improvement of insulin function. We think it improves insulin sensitivity. And we know that if you're an athlete, higher levels of vitamin D will build more type 2 fast twitch muscle fibers and muscle cells. And so the cool thing about that is as you build more muscle cells just in general by exercise, that can actually improve your insulin sensitivity as well. So there are some really key things that you can do to improve insulin sensitivity. So literally by looking at all these advanced biomarkers, you can see how insulin links everything together. And this is why I love to look at blood work, because it really helps people understand how their modification, which oftentimes is difficult to modify lifestyle and, you know, the nutrition and the exercise piece. But if you can show them the importance of it for them individually, and you can give them things to accomplish, saying, you know, I want your insulin below 6. You know, I want your free T3 or active thyroid hormone to be really good above 3. I want your vitamin D level to be above 60. I want to see your inflammation less than 1 on your CRP. And I want you to be a pattern A with a small amount of small dense LDL cholesterol. And I want your triglycerides nice and low. And I want your HDL nice and high. I mean, that gives them targets to shoot for with the lifestyle interventions. And then they do the lifestyle for 3 months or so, get repeat blood tests. They see all these changes. Do you think they're more likely to be compliant in the future? Once they realize that they've been empowered to literally change the way that they're going to age? The answer for many of my patients is yes. And so this is why I teach them about it, and I set specific goals for them so that they can really understand that they do have control. And it's really empowering, and it gives them faith in the process and what they're trying to do, particularly on the difficult days when they, you know, they just don't want to be a good patient, right? Insulin resistance, and I don't know, did you have any questions about that, Rita Marie?
Just, I would love to hear your comment on, you said below 6, and I know you and I have talked about 2 to 3 is actually really ideal.
Yeah.
But when you look at LabCorp and Quest, mm-hmm. the range is 2 to 19.
Yep.
And it seems ludicrous. So I'd love to hear your comments about that.
Well, first of all, with any blood test, even if you get samples that are seconds apart, you will notice that the values will change. And so what I'm really looking for in people is patterns. And so when it comes to insulin itself, yes, less than 2 would be ideal. And in fact, a lot of really optimally healthy people are less than 2. In fact, when I look at fasting insulin, it's less than 2. It's a biomarker of aging. It's one of the 2 main biomarkers that I look at for aging. So if I were to pick 2 biomarkers that I see consistently in the healthiest people that I have, insulin levels less than 2, and sex hormone binding globulin levels that are above normal or super normal. And those are the 2 biomarkers that are consistently seen in the healthiest people that I have. In the unhealthiest people that I have, if they don't yet have diabetes and burned out their pancreas, in other words, they can't make any more insulin, their insulin levels will be high and their sex hormone binding globulin will be very low, like around 10 or 15. And so, yes, insulin less than 2, of course, would be ideal. Now, I try to get targets for people. You know, less than 6 is really good. Less than 8 is pretty good. If you're looking at various reference ranges, and again, reference ranges are established by labs based upon their own patient populations. Just because you have a reference range that's up to 19 on one test, and I think with Quest it might be up to 12, if you have those reference ranges, just keep in mind those people that are on the higher end aren't necessarily your healthiest people. Mm-hmm. They just happen to fall within the reference range of 95% of the population. So, and by the way, you know, who also falls within that population is all the people with diabetes, who may not make much insulin yet. So you have to sort of take it in context of saying, you know, the lower, the better. You know, if you have prediabetes or higher blood sugars, you do want a responsive insulin. Because if let's say your blood sugar was, 200 and your insulin was less than 2, well, that's a big problem. That means your pancreas isn't working at all. It's not responding appropriately. But with a normal glucose and a nice fasting insulin that's nice and low, you can feel pretty good. The patterns that I see typically are insulins that are like, 15, 20, a blood sugar that's borderline, like 100, in the pre-diabetic range. And then your A1Cs that haven't gone up yet. Maybe they're 5.5 or something like that. And so this is a person very high risk that needs an intervention. When I say intervention, for me, I like to look at some of these other areas, the inflammation. I like to do an advanced lipid panel. I like to make sure the vitamin D is optimized, and I'll look at some of these hormones to make sure those aren't going to cause a problem. A lot of people who end up having insulin resistance and prediabetes actually have a thyroid problem, and many women have autoimmune thyroid disease. About 29 million women do. And if they happen to have Hashimoto's thyroid disease, where they have a very low functioning thyroid, or they may have, conversely, they may have Graves' disease, and they may have an autoimmune attack on the thyroid that's causing them to overproduce thyroid hormone. Both of these conditions can elevate the sugar and cause sugar problems. So the thyroid is essential to be checked in anyone who is dealing with sugar problems. So I like to at least do that one time for people and the first time I see them to make sure we don't miss that.
Wow. You are a wealth of information.
Well, I really appreciate that. I like hanging out with you because you are significantly trained and informed. I don't think I've met a person that knows so much about so many things.
Thank you.
All right. So just a couple more slides here. Insulin resistance. Of course, if you don't exercise, you don't tend to build muscle cells. And one of the main strategies that we see with people who have high levels of insulin, or even, in their higher end of the reference range, and they're not quite optimal, is I try to get them to build muscle. So I encourage resistance training. So this is lifting light weights and this kind of stuff, or lifting heavier weights, and really working on building muscle, because the more myocytes that you have, the more sensitive you will be to the insulin response. So build more muscle cells. If you happen to have belly fat, it's a great thing to target belly fat. Now, you can be skinny, by the way, and have what we call sick belly fat. Just because you're at your normal BMI, it doesn't mean that your belly fat is healthy. Up until recently, we were kind of played a guessing game with people. We would get these sophisticated tools to try to measure their belly fat, and then we would tell them you need to target a certain percentage. Nowadays, we can actually look directly at biomarkers to measure the health of your belly fat. And they're a little bit more expensive. I think for just under $200, you can check them on our site, but that's kind of expensive for just a couple biomarkers. But if a person's interested, they can actually look at their own belly fat to see if it's healthy or not. Genetically, some people are just born with the ability to build only a certain number of cells that are adipocytes or fat cells. And then as they, need more, they can't recruit anymore. And so that existing cell just gets sick. And unfortunately, when it gets sick, it starts releasing pro-inflammatory markers. And so now we measure leptin, which is a pro-inflammatory hormone that comes from adipocytes. And we measure adiponectin. And the adiponectin is an anti-inflammatory one. And we know that if we can get that level above 10, it is cardioprotective due to its anti-inflammatory effect. But belly fat is significantly responsive to insulin. And so it's one of the three places we develop significant insulin resistance when it happens. The first one's the liver, the second is skeletal muscle, and the third is the belly fat. And anyway, so if you have unhealthy belly fat, we call that adiposity. And unfortunately, adiposity is associated with increased problems dying. And the reason why is because you just build a lot more problems in your arteries from plaque due to all the pro-inflammatory markers that belly fat secretes. The belly fat, as it turns out, is the largest endocrine organ in our body. And we used to sort of just, not know a whole lot about it. But now we actually have biomarkers that can tell you the health of your belly fat. So on a lot of my patients who are willing to get their belly fat checked, we will measure their belly fat hormones, and we'll just take a look at those and see if it's a problem for them.
And so that's leptin and adiponectin are what you're measuring there?
That's correct. Yeah. So we'll measure the pro-inflammatory hormone called leptin and then the anti-inflammatory hormone called called adiponectin. And you'll notice that as a person gets healthier, so if a skinny person is eating terrible, they can develop adiposity, right? They don't have to, and the reason why is because that person just has trouble recruiting new fat cells, so the existing ones just expand and get bigger. And so we can measure this in the bloodstream and see. And as you correct their nutritional status, you'll notice that that leptin will come down and the adiponectin will go up. And so it's key for a lot of people to, you know, to look at this. Now, of course, the most common is, you know, a person who is obese. But then again, not all of obese people have insulin resistance. And the reason why is genetically, they have an eternal ability to create new adipocytes. Yeah, they eat more carbs, no problem. I'm just going to recruit another cell from my bone marrow to become an adipocyte. And that adipocyte just takes in the excess glucose, which is converted into free fatty acids and belly fat. And it just keeps happening. And so all they do is they gain weight, but they never develop diabetes and they never developed insulin resistance. And we're looking at them and we're wondering, why are they 400 pounds and they don't have diabetes?
Yeah.
You know, we all have diabetes. So if we're 20 or 30 pounds overweight, and this person here is hundreds of pounds overweight and they don't have diabetes. Well, the reason was why is because they had healthy belly fat, and genetically they were just given an advantage. I guess if you can call it that, they were given advantage to eat as much as they want without suffering the consequences of insulin resistance.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's adiposity. And then of course, chronic stress, you know, we do talk about this as it relates to cortisol, which is a stress hormone that can be measured. People that have higher levels of cortisol throughout the day, will spike their insulin. Commonly, you know, I still see people not sleeping enough. Sleep is where the hormones reset and cortisol is supposed to quiet down. And we start to work on that belly fat. We start deposing those free fatty acids out of those adipocytes and using them for energy and so on. And again, by the way, the visceral adiposity and the use of the free fatty acids from them, try to get the free fatty acids cleared up. This is where fasting can be really helpful, intermittent fasting. That intermittent fasting will force the use of these free fatty acids from these sick adipocytes and will create them, it will get them to shrink and get healthier. And then they'll stop releasing so much pro-inflammatory hormone. And of course, we'll notice significant weight loss because why the insulin resistance goes down and we stop storing fat. So anyway, chronic stress, cortisol is what we look at for that. Inflammation, again, that's CRP, is the measurement that we can do. If you want to measure the adipokines, the leptin would be the pro-inflammatory marker there. Genetic propensity, you know, there are some people, and I've seen plenty of them in my clinic, that are totally fine on their BMI. They're super healthy. I've had some athletes. I've had some firefighters and so on who just are in great shape. But they genetically have a problem with their insulin receptor, and they have insulin resistance. And so their insulin levels like super high, like 200, 400, something like that. And these people here require additional testing. It should never really be that high. So we're going to be looking at things like, you know, reactions to the insulin receptor. So we might measure antibodies to the insulin receptor and so on. But if you see somebody who has super high levels of insulin, you always want them seen by an endocrinologist to really try to figure out why, because it really should never be that high. It shouldn't be in the hundreds. That's really super high. High glycemic diet. Well, really any diet where you're just eating too much, is going to fill up your liver, which is sort of the first place we store energy, and we store glucose as glycogen in the liver. And then the second place is, of course, the muscle cells, which we have a lot of in most people. And those muscle cells also store glucose as glycogen primarily. And then in our fat cells, which can be, for some people, an eternal deposit of free fatty acids. And we basically take glucose in and store it as free fatty acids only in the adipocytes. That's where we don't create glycogen in the adipocytes. So free fatty acids are really something that we see primarily building up in tremendous amounts in people that just have sick adipocytes, and that leads to insulin resistance. And then, of course, smoking. Smoking is a cause of insulin resistance. So one of the best things that you can do for people if they have insulin resistance is to, you know, get them to stop smoking. And by the way, smoking independently increases your risk for stroke and heart attack. So why do you want to keep adding all these things together? And this is why we're seeing younger and younger people having earlier strokes and heart attacks like we've never seen before. Really, in the last 20 years of me practicing in the emergency room, we've gone from people having heart attacks in their 60s and 70s down to people having heart attacks in their 40s and 50s. You know, what's going on? Well, they're developing all these problems at a very young age now due to the way they're eating primarily. And then we're just not fixing them. I mean, we're letting this chronic disease run its course. And of course, you know more about this, the food industry and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, the whole medical industrial complex. And, you know, we're just not spending time with people and educating them and talking to them about how important it is to really change their lifestyle. Because when they do, you can see we start knocking off all of these things and reversing every single thing that's going on. The more educated we are, the better chance we have of getting healthier. That's for sure. Because we'll stick to it, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, doctors walk in the room now, and I'm one of them. So I'm complaining about our group of people. We walk in the room, we say you need to lose that weight and exercise, but yet we ourselves are 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 pounds overweight, and that's literally all we say with 1 hour of nutrition training in medical school. In fact, I was next to an ER buddy of mine who was I call him a junior colleague, but he's been out probably about 15 years now. And we were talking, and he was, you know, he knows about what I do. And so he was asking questions, and he's like, Alan, I just cannot believe that I only had an hour of nutrition in medical school. I literally can't believe it. And now everybody's overweight. They're all having these heart attacks. They're all having these young strokes, you know, like this is crazy. It is so crazy. The doctors are being put out, thousands and thousands of them, without any nutritional training of any relevance. And it's kind of sad. It really is sad.
Yeah. Very sad.
All right. So I know that you also have an optimal A1C goal, which is very low. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which I love. I mean, the lower, the better, obviously. And it really, it starts with the baseline. Where are you at it as a baseline? And then how good can you actually go? So just some definitions. Pre-diabetes is the 3-month measurement, which is your A1C. Pre-diabetes is defined as being from 5.7 to 6.4%. And then diabetes is 6.5% and above. This was changed fairly recently. The American Diabetes Association used to say 7% was type 2 diabetes. So again, whenever you look at these percentages, just know that at some point in time, some guys were just sitting around a room, some men and women are sitting around a room, and they were just looking at a bunch of labs, and they just sort of said, right here is the cutoff for diabetes.
Yeah.
What we found out in research, and I worked with the leader in research in pre-diabetes in the world. I mean, this guy's written about 700 papers on blood sugar problems, 700. And he won the Lifetime Achievement Award for the American Diabetes Association, at which time he told everyone, when he accepted the award, you know, it's supposed to be nice to people when they give you awards, he told them how they were all such a failure and that they were just ruining everything.
Wow.
And he's right. And he's right. Yeah. But what he's demonstrated in his papers is the damage starts far before a person gets to the diabetic state. Right. In fact, by the time they march from 5.7 to 6.4%, they will lose 50% of the volume of their pancreas. Okay. Imagine shrinking your organ down by 50%. And then they lose 80% of the efficiency. So how it works. So by the time you're actually at 6.5, that means that 50% of your pancreas is gone, unlikely to recover, and you've lost 80% of the efficiency. Now, the efficiency can be improved a little bit, but 80% loss is huge. And this is why you go one day from having a blood sugar, you know, around 115, that's a pre-diabetic range, to the next day, all of a sudden your blood sugar shoots up to 300 or 400. It's because you literally burn out enough of your pancreas that now it really can't do its job well at all. And unfortunately for many people, this is a sad story because we just can't convince doctors to take prediabetes seriously.
Yeah.
And you can see at the bottom of the slide, we have this thing called prediabetes centers. I was the medical director for this company. It was a national company. They put in $23 million trying to educate people about prediabetes, and it didn't work. They couldn't get anybody really interested in, you know, jumping on the pre-diabetes train. They got Joslin interested. They're the Joslin Diabetes Centers and so on. But, you know, 90% of people who have pre-diabetes don't have symptoms. And, you know, mm-hmm. they just, they don't, if you don't have symptoms, sometimes you don't care. sure, they wanted to lose a little bit of weight, but they didn't really understand how that was related to their numbers. And so that's what I spent a lot of years teaching, is really teaching people to look at their numbers and to understand that these numbers are really causing them problems. And once they figured out they could manipulate these lab tests through their lifestyle interventions, then they got really excited because they realized they actually were in control. Because they really weren't getting a lot of good information from their doctor most of the time. Now, research says, and this is from Diabetes Care in 2010, that when they looked at all of the research and they did a Cochrane review or a systematic review, they found out that you were at risk even if you were at 5.5%. So, of course, 6.5% is diabetes, but even if you're at 5.5, and so really the research is saying you need to be under 5.4, so 5.4 or less. And yours is what? Is it under 5 or is it even
less? Yeah, I like to see it between 4.5 and 5 because to me, 5.4 is too close to comfort to 5.5. I mean, if 5.5 is starting to be at high risk, I want people, you know, if you're starting to creep above 5, then there's a problem and you need to address it.
Yeah. Now, I will say the one thing about A1C alone, if that's all you're ever checking is an A1C, A1Cs are very imprecise. In other words, there are some things that can interfere with the measurement of A1C. And so I don't just like to look at an A1C. If a person, say, is taking aspirin or if a person is taking high-dose vitamin C, that can actually interfere with the way that we measure A1Cs. So your A1C might be 5.4 one time, and the next time it's 4.5.
Yeah.
Of course, if you donate blood too, that can also falsely lower your A1C. Because you're usually getting blood from somebody, and it's usually plasma and so on, so it'll dilute the amount of A1C that you have. So if you went and donated blood, and you're an A1C of 6 and it went down to 5 and you think you're the greatest, it just
no, you just diluted your blood. That's all you did.
So you really have to take it in context of maybe some other biomarkers, and this is why I like to look at fasting insulin, the glucose, and the A1C together. Yep. And really sort of map that out. Do you have a problem with your insulin? No. Do you have a problem with your A1C? No. Do you have a problem with your glucose? No, you're good.
Yeah. And when you say glucose, I know, you know, typically in medicine, it's fasting glucose, but that's not real accurate because it takes a long time. That's why I like to look at postprandial glucose.
Yeah. In fact, that was my last slide to talk about how we really, the gold standard, the gold standard is the way we look at postprandial. This is something more from research. We would calculate these on everybody that we saw. They were called HOMO-IR. Unfortunately, Quest doesn't really do this for us. I think they came out with a panel where they're going to do it. But it's just a mathematical calculation, and it gives us just a range to look at. And really what it is it's looking for your risk of insulin resistance. And so if your number is above five, you're at high risk. 2.5 to 5 is moderate, and of course, low is less than 2.5. So you always want to see people low. And if you really want to know what the calculation is, they take your fasting glucose and times your fasting insulin, and then divide it by 405. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is how we come up with this HOMO-IR.
And there are calculators that you can do, and we have one in the sweet spot on the glucose testing page.
Perfect. All right. Perfect. Yeah. So following HOMO-IR is interesting, along with looking at your glucose and your A1C and so on. Now, the gold standard is exactly what you talked about, and that's actually giving yourself some type of a challenge and really seeing how your pancreas performs. Now, the issue with this always is after you need to know how much you're giving yourself in order to figure out how safe you are at 1 hour and 2 hours. Now, I'll just tell you what we did. So anyone who we thought was at risk, in other words, maybe they had a baseline A1C and it was going up, and we either didn't trust the A1C because it was somewhat imprecise, or we were really concerned about somebody because their insulin level was high and now their A1C was climbing, we would say, shoot, let's just do a 2-hour glucose tolerance test. And really all this is drinking the equivalent of a Sprite. It's about 37 grams, I think, is in a Sprite or something like that. You give them a glucose load. So the standard glucose load is 75 grams of glucose. And it's an orange syrupy substance that tastes terrible if anybody's ever had it. Mm-hmm. You could give them 2 Sprites, and that would just about be right on, 38 times 2. So that would be really close to doing it. So if you're going to do it on yourself, I would drink 2 Sprites over 10 minutes. After getting a baseline blood sugar, And then I would wait 1 hour, and at 1 hour, that number definitely needs to be less than 140. And then at 2 hours, it needs to be less than 140. And that is just so that you, that's to diagnose you as having no impaired glucose tolerance. So let's talk about that a little bit. So what I'm really telling you is that now, and you have the ability to check your blood sugars, right? You could literally go and get two Sprites, drink them within 10 minutes, and then at an hour, check your blood sugar, 2 hours, check your blood sugar. If your number at 1 hour is above 155, that is the single greatest predictor of who's going to go on to develop diabetes. So anybody I see who has a level of 155 at 1 hour, I really worry about them. Now, if they did quite a bit more carbs, so in other words, instead of giving them two things, a Sprite, maybe they drank three. Well, then this whole thing goes out the there's no research behind it. So I couldn't tell you what that number would be. So if you really want to know, and you really want to do this at home, I would recommend trying to get as close to 75 grams of sugar as possible and use that as your marker for this number that I'm telling you. Because if your number is over 155 at 1 hour, that is the single greatest predictor of whether or not you'll go on to develop diabetes. And the higher it is above 155, the higher your risk is for developing diabetes. And then, of course, at 2 hours, if you're between 140 and 199, you have impaired glucose tolerance, which is a concern, and that's more of a pre-diabetic condition. If it's above 200, then that's consistent with diabetes. And I've had people with A1Cs of 5.3 that are actually diabetics when we run them through this. So it's really as somebody whose A1Cs are just increasing, or maybe their insulins are high and their glucose has been kind of iffy. If you really want to know, just give them a couple Sprites, have them check their blood sugar at 1 hour and then at two. And if they're above 155 and above 200, they're diabetic. I mean, that's just true. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, the earlier that we intervene with diabetes, the better. Now, I also put on here that is the reasons why we would sort of do it in the clinic. Anyone who had a fasting glucose of 100 to 125, we would just pull the trigger and do it. If you had an A1C that was 5.7 to 6.9, and you might say, well, why did you do it at 6.9? I mean, that's clearly diabetes. Well, the reason why is because that person at 6.9 may have had a blood sugar that was pretty normal, or like 115. And I've told you that there are some things that interfere with the way that we test A1C. And so if I had somebody like that I was worried, their sugar wasn't already 200, I would be like, well, hey, let's really see if this person has diabetes or not, and let's do a glucose tolerance test. And several times, you know, they would pass, and they would have normal glucose tolerance, so they were happy about that. And then, of course, anyone who had what we call a positive San Antonio diabetes prediction model, for people that have taken my lab masterclass, and Rita Marie, you have access to this, there's an Excel spreadsheet in there that you can download, and it's called the San Antonio diabetes prediction model. And it takes into account a person's age, their gender, their ethnicity, and their blood pressure, and then their HDL cholesterol. And it puts it into this formula. And this is a research-driven scoring system. And it turns out that if their number is greater than 6.5%, their risk of developing diabetes is significantly higher, like 40 times higher than if it were less than 6.5. And so it can be yet another tool to try to encourage people to, you know, get in the swing of things and do something. So I'm all about trying to put data in front of someone, teach them about, you know, what it means, and give them an opportunity to reverse it, and then be proud of themselves for doing it. Because it just makes a more compliant person over time. And so anyway, so that's what that is. Another indication might be to get a glucose tolerance test is in anybody who develops unexplained increasing glucoses or A1Cs. Now, keep in mind, we're checking people's thyroids, you know, before all this stuff. You know, we're looking at their sleep and their cortisol and all that. So we're doing this for people that were really, you know, otherwise there's no explanation for these A1Cs and glucoses, and we just want to be sure. So it is the gold standard, and you talk a lot about this. So I think that is pretty much it there for my presentation on that. Rita Marie, is there anything that you had questions on that you wanted to talk about in regards to this?
No, I love this picture and I love the way that you presented this. I would just say we teach a lot of this in Sweet Spot, and the only difference is I don't ask anybody to do a glucose tolerance like that, because I find that if we because I don't want anybody to load themselves up with two Sprites or that orange goopy stuff. But what we do is I just tell people, eat your highest normal carbohydrate meal and let's see what happens. And surprisingly, you know, we look for the peak. So I don't look just at an hour and 2 hours. I'll look to see, you know, because some people peak at a half hour, some people 45 minutes. So I want to see how high it goes. And then I want it back down to below 100 by 2 hours. For what I'm looking at is like pre-diabetes, right? Pre-insulin resistance. Are you on that 30-year trajectory towards diabetes? Maybe you never will get diabetes, but if you're having these high spikes of glucose and insulin throughout, you're still having the same damages. And even if you never get diabetes, you still may have peripheral vascular disease. You still may have retinopathies. You still may have kidney stress and certainly cardiovascular. So I'm a little bit more strict about it because I think that we can find people in earlier stages and help them to prevent going down that path and having, you know, irreversible damage happening.
So. Yeah. And I was going to say the thing about diabetes, if you want to think about it, if you have one parent with diabetes, you know, you're at high risk. If you have two parents with diabetes, you're at super high risk. So the first place to look before you need to even look at yourself is look at your family, look where you came from, and just know that even though you might be eating great, you might be at your normal BMI like I am. And I, you know, I think I eat well most of the time. Amy Beth may disagree with me, but I think I eat well most of the time and I'm at my normal BMI. My dad has diabetes, you know, and so I always have to be paranoid that I'm going to get diabetes because genetically these cells are pre-programmed to die. Yep. And they will start dying and I can make them die faster if I eat terrible. That I can certainly do, but I can also make insulin more sensitive, by doing other things like building muscle and so on. And, so there are some, you know, so first just look at your parents and that will give you, you know, some impetus to really look at yourself. But yeah, you're right. I think everyone can be optimized. And over in Europe, they send people down to the local 7-Eleven or whatever they call it there, and they have them get what's called a glucola. And in that glucola, there's 75 grams of sugar. And that's how they do every glucose tolerance test. They don't pay these companies to give them the orange syrup. They just say, go to 7-Eleven on your way into the clinic and then do that. I do have a somewhere in my batch of educational materials, if you're interested in this, I actually do have what happens with insulin and glucose graphed out. And I should have put it in this presentation, but it's an actual graph of what happens when you give the 75 grams of sugar.
Oh yeah. I have that graph in my presentation that I did.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Because that's really interesting. And you know, of course, one of the things that we don't often even think about looking at is the insulin as we're looking at the glucose. And in an ideal world, we would do what's called an enhanced glucose tolerance test, where we look at a baseline fasting insulin and a baseline fasting glucose. We give the 75-gram load, and then we look at your insulin and your glucose at 1 hour and then again at 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And then you can actually see a dynamic response of your pancreas to the glucose. And there are diabetic patterns that can develop. And there's things called reassuring responses and non-reassuring responses. And so that's not something that many people do. We actually do offer that on our website. So if you go to yours, which is, I think, runmylabs.com, and you click on the sugar tab, there's a 2-hour glucose tolerance test there as an option, but that also includes insulin. And so you will get back from that. You'll actually get the insulin and glucose numbers measured 3 times, you know, one before you start and then one at 1 hour, one at 2 hours. And if you have access to my graph that looks at insulin along with glucose, you can just sort of plot right where you're at and see if you're at a reassuring pattern. But I mention that because that really is the gold standard. It's the best test out there. And it's something that we love to do in people who we think either have prediabetes or maybe they're close to being prediabetic and we're really worried about them. And we like to do that because it really, you know, helps people to understand where they're at on the journey.
It inspires to do something.
Yep.
Yep, absolutely. Wow. So thank you for all that you shared and great graphics and great pictures. And I really appreciate you coming back. I don't know what happened during the event when we had to
I'm technically challenged. So, I mean, I can take full responsibility for that. I have no idea. I can't even figure it out. I wanted to say we do have the ability, if people want to download my cheat sheets, which looks at the metabolic markers like adiponectin and leptin and some of these other things I talk about. I'll give you that link. And yep. it's really a link where people can just, if they just give me their name, email, just first name. I don't need last names. Then I will email them the actual sheet that lists all those optimal values, and so on. So they can look at that. It's not so much about the optimal values. It's the huge value there. It's going to be the recommendations of things that you can start to do in your own life. And I'm sure many of these that you do recommend, but for adiponectin and leptin, there's some interesting things and some other things on there that I think people would find interesting. So if they want to, you have that link, I think.
Yeah, I think that was what you gave us to offer as a bonus for the people who joined our program this week.
Okay, great. So if for whatever reason they don't have it or they need it, then I'll send it to you.
Yeah. You sent it to me a while back, like last weekend.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, perfect.
Yep. Okie dokie. All right. Yay. I think that would be really cool. So thank you for being here. And I hope this was very informative for everybody. It's really clarified a lot of things and the importance of testing. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Stop recording.